Socrates. Like the Buddha, Lao Tzu, and Jesus, none of what Socrates may have said was written in his own hand. We know what we know of him by what others have told us about him. But unlike these other holy men, his life was recorded by those who knew him personally while he was yet alive. What is told about him is corroborated even by his enemies. His life is not factitious legend, as so much and so often our other holy men shall prove to be the stock of fabulous tales. We know for fact that he lived and died, as it was reported. He lived and died poor. He lived and died by choice. He lived and died for philosophy. We are told that once a student of Anaxagoras, he became a philosopher in his own right in his middle age. But Diogenes Laertius, by his own misanthropic predilection, perhaps, preferably exalted the particular influence of his cankerous wife, Xantippe, who it seems was ashamed of their common poverty because of his idleness and would not permit entertainment of his philosophical band in their humble home, and who so continuously chastised her husband that he therefore took to walking the streets, and there requited himself upon neighbors and strangers in overwrought colloquy. Well practiced, perhaps, by the carping of his wife, he became so skilled in argument that he was infamous for it. His wife conditioned him, he said, as her name implied by etymology, that she was a horse that is not easily ridden. She chased him herself even to the streets, where once she tore the clothes off his back. And in another instance, Diogenes Laertius reports, she doused him with their chamber pot. Our Socrates resembles nothing in all of this except in fate. Some should find her more like she who was his inspiration than he who was inspired. Socrates, Newton, 1637. The crickets cheer in the woodbox next to the stone hearth, the wide, tall hearth whose open mouth is mammoth for the purpose of communal cooking and heating, the expanse of the hall which is so large that a person or two or three might stand, if stooped, within it. The sooty vault shimmers with the bed of heaped embers and the quiet licks of occasional flame on charred logs, keeping the long hall poorly heated, as winter savagely assaults it from all sides. But keeping a kettle simmering, where it hangs by a wrought iron arm swung over these embers and the niggard fire. The meeting house of Newton lies at length before this huge hearth, a long hall wherein the faithful stand for lengthy sermons on the Sabbath, but today it is furnished for the trial, which is reconvened upon the matter of Goody Coxwell, wife of Henry Coxwell of Boston. She is not present. The magistrate Winthrop speaks with Mr. Cotton, minister of her own congregation at First Church in Boston. They sit opposite one another at opposite ends of the long table before the hearth. Tea is prepared by a woman as they speak. She will not come to this summons excepting that she be called under her maiden name. explains Mr. Cotton. It is an additional outrage and insolence, replies Winthrop. Perhaps, but her suit of divorce has merit. But she is not divorced. Nevertheless, she shall answer only to her maiden name, Faith Ashley. She shall answer as God commands and as the church ordains, and as she is wife to Coxwell, so Coxwell she shall be. Winthrop curses the crickets. An unobtrusive black-gowned widow who attended him brings him a mug of tea, which in the chill is smoldering with steam. Mr. Cotton takes his also. The mugs shall serve to warm their hands as much as the tea shall serve to satisfy other appetites. I dare say these insects. I cannot say the look of them fiendish and the sound of them relentless is any of the worst of nagging. He stands and kicks the wood box, and the crickets are silenced for a time. I blame myself, John, said the Reverend sadly. She was, you know, daughter to my mentor, who taught me Hebrew, and it was I who encouraged her to join us in this colony. She was froward, though a woman of quick mind and strong purpose, and I admit she possesses no less erudition than mine own, though hers be entirely self-developed, or rather cultivated by her father over the years of his prolonged infirmity. I know, says Winthrop, resuming his chair. Blind as Samson since his widowhood. Her enduring patience and obedient charity preserved him. Like a dutiful daughter ought, she faithfully and cheerfully nursed him in his trials, his balm, his succor, enabling his worship and the scholarship which sustained him, reading and transcribing for him his texts of Latin, Greek, even Hebrew. And I understand how she has therefore assisted thee. I shall confess to you, some sermons that I wrote may be as much her words as mine. I know. That is why it is so terrible upon thee. It hurts me greatly, sighs Cotton. She has been more than child, more than kin to me. I might think she were part of my own mind, a portion of my soul. For that very reason, therefore, Mr. Cotton, she must be cast out. For the sake of thy soul, indeed. Some, not I, but some shall certainly see complicity in thee, sojourner of her error, if she not be done to as the law requires. Your pleadings on her behalf become your portion of guilt for her crimes. Do you not see this, John? Yes, yes. Cotton shakes his head wearily. The widow, bent, arthritic, whose left hand is uselessly limp by recent stroke, who drags a leaden foot deadened by a previous stroke, who is thus dying day by day in her parts, one by one, and by degrees, who nonetheless works for him from before dim dawn until after dreary dusk, is his scullery maid. Tends his chamber pots, washes his soiled underclothes as best she can with the caustic rye soap he provides. Scrabbles away from the fireplace. She tends into the anteroom when she hears him begin to speak, so that she would not be tempted to listen to what she ought not to hear. It is difficult not to listen, not to hear him, because his voice is so large and so self-conscious, enlarging to be heard, and he always has opinions he wants others to hear. At the kitchen table, with a solitary guttering taper before her, little Hope Coxwell sits across from her father and looks at her hands folded in her lap, her little legs dangling from the high-backed chair. As he drinks his customary draught from his pewter tankard, and listens to him explain that her mother had brought her shame and adversity upon her own head, and how he had given testimony as his duty as an elder, how she should be cautioned and chastened by the example of her lapsed mother, who shall be necessarily cast out of the community of God, to wander the wilderness of brute beasts and heathens, or shall be exiled to the outposts of malefactors, devil worshippers, and atheists. She, well-schooled, obedient, God-fearing, listens without expression of opinion or revelation of emotion, without raising her head, without raising her eyes. Henry Coxwell recalls for her, as his daughter sat gripping her hands in her lap, how his goodly wife had been meek, had been chaste, had been as wives ought, circumspect and deferential to him, her proper master under the ordinance of God and man, when first she had arrived from Lincolnshire with Reverend Cotton. How well advised he had been to marry her, though she was lanky, lean, not fit to stew were she a chicken, and plain in the face, even coarse, and inclined to scold, and harshly disagreeable. But how she seemed well and truly mollified by her misfortune, her desiccated virginity, her withered youth, the poverty of her mean dowry, and how also he was well and truly gratified by her obsequious modesty, shy and uncomfortable, in the embrace of her manful husband, he, who may have had, might he have preferred instead, a maiden in winsome youthful bloom, but had chosen her, precisely for her full maturity, her vigor, her sage learning and industrious capacity. She would be employed by Reverend Cotton, he was told. She would, therefore, more than earn her keep. As an investment, she was capital with interest, and so she should serve as wife, housekeeper, breeder of his lineage, and shall as well keep his books, account his stores, his trade, and facilitate his correspondence. He loathed these details himself. But then, he bitterly slurs, changed. I do not know wherefore. Changed, changed, like a moon of misery, changed like a sickness. It was a change of sickness, a change within which affected her, like the hue of the moon, changed by the ill cast of a wicked sky. She looked changed, though still ugly that she always was. Oh, I cannot stand to see that face. Though she is the same, I do not deny. Yet I swear she was now malignant in her look, in her manner, in her expression. Her affections waned, sickly as a sickened moon. Her acid words scour me like bilious cloud that sickly scours the sickened moon. Her once kindly, matronly affection upon me was now sick, a stink, a nasty, sour distemper that she did vomit upon me. And she, discourteous, willful, haughty, oh, I liked her not. I liked nothing about her. I told the Reverend, would she die ere I should die? God grant divorce, I cried, for the misery of her company. God grant me the grace for the burden of faith. crickets disturbed in the woodpile, all black and horned. They are not seen because they do not move. But when one sounds, he strikes at the woodpile and it leaps up and dives into the puzzles of darkness among the woodpile, which swallow it. And there it silently hides. Winthrop feels his flesh crawl. Governor Van sits across from the heretic Williams. At a table in a farmhouse beyond the border of the colony, where neither have jurisdiction and none may make discovery of their meeting. The Quaker widow, whose home it is, brings tea from the hearth, where its shadow-casting fire is the only light upon the room. In her room alone above, where her husband and her daughter sat in the kitchen, in the glow of her own frosty breath, Faith is sitting at a table and writing under the golden aura of a steady light from an ancient Greek wickless oil lamp, burning smokeless. Its teardrop flame suspended like a clear yellow gem above the small, round mouth of the delicate spout. She is writing her petition and argument. Tertullian ad scapulum. It agreeth both with human reason and natural equity that every man worship God uncompelled, and believe what he will, for it neither hurteth nor profiteth any one another man's religion and belief. Neither beseemeth any religion to compel another to be of their religion, which willingly and freely should be embraced, and not by constraint. Brentius, upon 1 Corinthians 3. No man hath power to make or give laws to Christians, whereby to bind their consciences, for willingly, freely, and uncompelled, with a ready desire and cheerful mind, must those that come run unto Christ. Luther, in his Book of the Civil Magistrates, saith, "The laws of the civil magistrates' government extend no further than over the body or goods, unto that which is external. For over the soul God will not suffer any to rule, only he himself will rule there. Wherefore, whosoever doth undertake to give laws to the souls and consciences of men, he usurpeth that government himself, which appertains unto God," and so on. She lifts the quill to dip into the pot of the ink, breaking the ice which surfaces it. Next to it sits a cricket singing. She speaks to it what she thinks she will write, and it is silenced as she speaks, and does not sing again until she writes again. Facing him across the table in a farmhouse beyond the border of the colony, Governor Van says to the heretic Williams, "I can do no more. The horses shall be laid by nonetheless. Winthrop shall undo me. He has the evidence of your complicity. I attended once. I attended to hear as many did, as you did, as you. But it was not heresy which is portrayed. She spoke of the interpretation of nature. She had the Indian present, did she not? And the old midwife whom they imprison. The Quaker woman who abides speaks. She is but an old woman, a widow like so many. Why do they fear an old woman, a widow? She mends bones. She healed a child in the village by her physique. You know this. The two men, looking upon one another, did not acknowledge the interruption. Governor Van. Goodly Coxwell shall not be saved unless she saves herself. I can do no more. Winthrop crushes a cricket with his heel. Reverend Cotton departs on horseback for Boston. Faith writes at the table in her room. Coxwell slouches and sleeps, his head upon the table, his mouth drools. His hand clasped to his flagon's handle tips it, spilling what remains. His daughter rises and retreats from the table, backing from the room, watching her father, fearing to wake him. Reverend Cotton had bundled his legs, his feet, before straddling his horse, and letting it plod homeward through the starry night between snowy stubble fields, through looming forests to descend from these hills to the widespread bay and bright-windowed Boston nestled against them. Gratefully, the wind had subsided, the sky cleared. The frost air does not bite as harshly as it might. The only sounds are those clops of the patient horse upon the windswept frozen track, the well-traveled passage which he had thrice in the week himself taken for the trial of Goody Coxwell. He thinks of her. Give me the liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties, she had said to him, quoting another. Words also uttered, unfortunately, by the heretic Williams, who had heard those words uttered firsthand by their great author, a martyr to the lost cause, one to whom God had given divine insight to compensate his blindness, one to whom Cotton, as all Puritans, held considerable intellectual and moral indebtedness. Cotton wholly agreed in his heart with him, but he could not agree in practice, not as a civil authority, not as a minister of the truth. The virtue of truth shall not be tested. When tested, it shall necessarily compromise. It must be lived with. Now he must contend with her. She shall certainly use his own words against him. She shall certainly cite his own sermons, ones she herself had written for him, but which he had authorized and which he had uttered as his own. Now, the Reverend said, I must contend with myself. How shall I? Accused of fraternizing with savages, of pursuit of unholy knowledge, of witchcraft, of craven willfulness and independence, of heresy and free thinking, of corruption of others, of inducing licentious behavior. In particular, the charges shall be sustained by evidence of her relationship with the old Indian, of certain books in her keeping, of her speech to others, of her cabals, her night meetings, in which women were solicited to her secret opinions in matters not fit, and the lewd congress there of men unmarried to such women unmarried, and the rumor of such matters as generally known. Some of the secret opinions were these: that there is no inherent righteousness in a child of God, that neither absolute nor conditional promises belong to a Christian, that we are not bound to the law, not as a rule, that the Sabbath is but as other days, that the soul is mortal, and the body also, that there is no resurrection of the body. Of most of these matters, he believes it is not true. Of the so-called secret opinions, he believes that these are speculations of philosophy, not mature opinions. She has said to him, has she not? Philosophy, when superficially studied, excites doubt. When thoroughly explored, it dispels it. She would look to see. She would see to know. She would know to believe. This is her way. She is no heretic thereby. She has said to him, has she not, that they deny a God, deny that which we cannot grasp, because it may not be grasped. But what is not grasped is what we must reach for. Without seeking, we find nothing. He is aware that he is speaking out loud to himself, and that his horse, if it understood him, had nothing to say to him. He considers the horse the wiser of the two of them on the road that night. Getting home after midnight, he will not bed until he has warmed his feet at his hearth, for they hurt with the damp and the cold. The widow, who had warmed his bed for him, kneels and rubs his feet as he imbibes brandy. At the meeting house in Newton, Winthrop sits at the table, and in the gleam of a candelabra, having dismissed the widow to her straw bed, he takes up his pen, as was his diligent habit, and enters upon his journal some further details of recent history. The devil would never cease to disturb our peace and to raise up instruments one after another. At Weymouth, where Mr. Lenthal, late of England and an imbiber of Mrs. Coxwell's opinions, had settled, Mr. Cotton was appointed to treat him and correct him of his errors. He finally retracted, but some of his followers, notably Mr. Britton, must be fined and whipped, and still do not relent. There was also that woman in Salem, one Goodwife Oliver, who had suffered somewhat in England for refusing to bow at the name of Jesus, though otherwise she was conformable. Here she also had attended upon Mrs. Coxwell's errors. She was, for her ability of speech, zeal, and devotion, far beneath Mrs. Coxwell, and so a less fit instrument to have done hurt to us, was poor and had little acquaintance. But this woman was brought to my court for disturbing the peace in the church, and there she gave such peremptory answers as she was committed till she should find sureties for her good behavior. After she had been in prison 3 or 4 days, she found means to Governor Van and submitted herself. He interceded, and she disingenuously acknowledged her fault in disturbing the church, whereupon the governor took her husband's bond for her good behavior and discharged her out of prison, despite my protestations. But I found, by other evidence afterwards, that she still held her former opinions, which were very dangerous. This woman was therefore adjudged to be whipped for reproaching the magistrates. She stood without tying, and bore her punishment with a masculine spirit, glorying in her suffering. I required a cleft stick put on her tongue 30 minutes for reproaching the elders. At Providence, where that miscreant society has been banished from us, the devil is also busy, even at their first coming thither. Mr. Williams and the rest of his misfits did issue the arrogant edict of their foul dictum that no man should be molested for his supposed conscience. So even now wives and children and servants shall claim liberty of conscience, shall declare to attend all manner of religious meetings or otherwise, even those of Mrs. Coxwell. Because one Goodman Vernon refused to let his wife go, Williams, as would-be governor to this perverse colony, was presented him to be censured. But there stood up another man, Goodman Arnold, a witty man, dear to his bosom, an original follower, who rightfully defied him, telling him that when he, Arnold, had consented to join their society, he never intended his consent should extend to the breach of the ordinance of God, such as the subjection of wives to their husbands. And then he gave diverse solid reasons against obedience to this unwanted liberty of conscience, which ought not to be granted to women or children, as unfit to them as it would be for beasts to reason. Then one Green, who hath married the wife of one Beggarly, whose husband is yet living, and having no divorce, therefore lives in adultery, and has confessed it, he replied that if they restrain their wives, all the women in the country would cry out at them. Arnold answered him thus, "Would you now break an ordinance and commandment of God to please women?" Arnold told them that it was not the women's desires to go to meetings, but only Mr. Williams and Faith Coxwell's. When in conclusion they would have censured Vernon and reprimanded Arnold for his support of him, Williams told them it was against their convictions to do so, for Vernon did what he did out of his conscience, and no man should be censured for his conscience. Ah, thus wicked men are entangled by perverse reason, deception by Satan disguised by the appearance of righteousness. How the clever serpent beguiles them, how ensnares them in his coils. Thus this libertine society stews in lewdness.